I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to The Reference Desk, a podcast where two librarians take you down the rabbit hole of the topics that have bewitched us.
So adjust the chain on your reading glasses, button up your favorite cardigan, and follow us punk-ass book jackies through the stacks to The Reference Desk. Hello!
Hello!
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. This is our first time recording on a weeknight.
I know. Wow.
It's very odd.
So how has your week been going?
It's been okay. We've all been sick again.
Oh, no.
I'm just so sick of it.
Yes.
So a lot of our plans got scrapped. We were supposed to go to like this big pumpkin festival thing last weekend that my dad was playing at, and we ended up canceling it. And like just trying to decide, like, just do I send Rory to school or not? And should I even be sending her to school? Like, this is making me question everything. I'm like, I get it. Kids get sick when they go into childcare, but with it being COVID, I'm like, I don't know if I can do this.
Yeah. It's scary.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were – so Finn's daycare provider got COVID, and so we were quarantining him for 2 weeks. And then, like, at the very end of those 2 weeks, Tom got a cold, and then Finn got a cold, and then I got a cold. And I was like, is it close enough? Like, is it COVID? What's happening?
Right.
It wasn't, but
– That's good.
Yeah. Good news.
Yeah. I feel like it's just so hard right now having little kids that aren't vaccinated and like trying to make the right decision for them.
Yeah.
Oh, it's tough.
Yeah. That's why whenever someone argues when they come in the library and they don't want to wear a mask, it's like kids cannot get vaccinated right now.
Just, right.
It's not that hard.
Yes, and kids also touch everything,
everything,
and put everything into their mouth. They're
one gross. Day it'll be over.
Someday.
Welcome to our first episode of season two.
Yay, it is season two. It is. Wow, it is. And we are still in the middle of a global pandemic.
Imagine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, this is exciting. All right. So this concludes our first episode of season two.
That's it. Bye. Well, we've had an interesting weekend as we're recording. So this will go out in November. But it is currently October. And we just had Finn's birthday party this weekend, which was fun. It was Halloween themed. So that was great.
So fun.
And then we immediately, just because that wasn't enough excitement for one weekend, we decided to take down his crib and put up his toddler bed. And, you know, at first he was not loving it, of course. And and then that first nap, he was – I sent you the picture of him like half on his bed, half off of it. Like, I don't know. I'm still protesting.
Yeah.
And then that night he just climbed right in and he's just been fine ever since.
Oh, so funny.
No, so that's why I was like, we can't have another kid because he has ruined us for children. Like, he's such a good child.
Yep. I feel that way about Rory.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
Everything that people were like, oh, it's going to be such a fight. Like, giving up a pacifier just one day on her own. She just set it down, never went back to it.
Yep.
It's just been like everything. She's just been so easy. And I'm like, yeah, this is never going to happen again.
No, for sure. It's not. I will say, though, we also this weekend went to, we have an Appalachian magic and remedy store here called Pyramid. It's really awesome.
I'm so sorry. I was ooing. Can you repeat the name?
Yeah. It's called Pyramid. And I love it. It's such a fantastic store. So we went in this weekend, and usually Finn's really good in there, but he was just having a time for some reason. And of course he wanted to touch everything. So finally he settled on like this one little chime candle, like a little beeswax pillar candle. And I was like, fine, just hold on to it. This is yours. You will buy it. You can have it. Mm-hmm. So we're walking around the store and I turn my head and he's eating it.
No. So-
It's like, all right, I guess it's time to go. My kid is eating a candle.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it was natural beeswax, so it's probably fine. I don't know.
Was it scented?
No, it was just normal. Normal? So regular? I don't know.
It wasn't even like it like smelled like cookies or something.
No, it was just wax.
Oh, my God.
So,
God bless him.
Oh, goodness. But that was my weekend.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What have you been reading or watching or doing?
Yeah, so I have been, I started reading like three horror books at once because I usually have like an audiobook going, an ebook going, and a print book going, mm-hmm. all at different places. But the more that I was reading, like one of them is a haunted house book called The Haunting of Lee Parker, I think it is, by Darcy Coates. And she writes a lot of just haunted house ghost stories. But I kept thinking, like, I'm worried I'm going to start taking ideas from these books when I go to start writing my own haunted house story without, like, knowing it. So I put them down, and I've just been kind of researching Appalachia folk magic. And also I've decided – so I am – I don't know if you know this about me, Katie. Of course you do. I'm a little anxiety ridden and very meticulous about planning.
No.
So this always comes up when I go to start writing a book, because I'm like, I need to know the perfect way to make an outline. I need to know the perfect way to sit down and research this book. Mm-hmm. So I've decided instead, I am just going to pull tarot cards. And let tarot cards plot my book for me.
Wow.
And it'll just be a fun exercise. No pressure. Just
sure,
practice.
Why not?
Yeah.
There's no right way or wrong way.
Right. Yeah. So I'm just going to ask some questions and pull some cards and whatever the cards are. That's how I'm going to write my book. So we'll see how that goes. This
Very cool. Turn.
Yeah. But that's all I've been, I kind of stopped reading.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Yeah. So for those of you who don't know Haley, this is a girl who before she goes to a new restaurant has to Google the menu
yep.
and have it picked out what she's going to order.
Yes.
Before Absolutely. We even go to the restaurant because mm-hmm. the pressure of looking at a menu at a restaurant is far too great.
Yes. And I want to know, is it like a sit down restaurant? Do you have to go up to somebody and like actually talk to them first? Mm-hmm. I want to know all the things. Yeah. So this is going to be a new adventure.
For sure. Yeah.
Maybe it'll work like therapy. I don't know.
Hey, you know, I don't know. I mean, I told you my anxiety this week was my psychiatrist asking me to take my pulse rate, which is a very simple thing to do. But instead, I just panicked and pretended to be taking my pulse and Googled what the normal pulse rate was for women my age and told him that.
Anxiety, folks. Ta-da. So besides reading up on average pulse rates, have you been reading anything else?
It's a very wide range. Anything between 80 and 100 is considered normal. So,
well, that's a pretty big gap.
It really is. I went with 89.
Safe. It's pretty in the middle. Yeah. Safe.
So I've pretty much just been like falling into a NyQuil coma at night and not really reading. Oh. But I have been trying to get caught up on the We Can Do Hard Things podcast with Glennon Doyle. I'm sure I've mentioned her before, but she's the author of Untamed and just one of my favorite humans. She does a lot of really great work with a nonprofit called Together Rising, and just she's wonderful. So anyways, she's hosting a live virtual pre-launch of her new journal / workbook thing that goes along with Untamed. And it's called Get Untamed, the Journal. So it's going to be like a virtual conversation with her, her wife, Abby Wambach, who is amazing, and her sister, Amanda Doyle, who co-hosts her podcast with her. And she selected 6 all Black-owned bookstores that you can purchase the tickets through. Awesome. So all of the proceeds go right to those, and that ticket gets you access to the event live and a pre-order of the journal that will come in time for the event. So you can like follow along as you watch.
Awesome.
So I bought one of those for me and my mom.
Very cool.
And I'm hoping that we can watch it together. I haven't told her yet, so
surprise!
I bought you this thing. So anyways, that's November 18th at 8 p.m. If anyone is interested. And if you register by November 5th, you're guaranteed to get that early shipment so that you have it in time for the event. So if you want to register for that, just go to Glennon's Instagram. She's Glennon Doyle, and the link is in her bio.
Super cool.
Yeah, so that's pretty much all I have to plug.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
So I had like this whole intro written, and then based on my day-to-day, I just scrapped it all and tried to like scribble down something. I don't know if it's just me, but have you noticed that people are like hot lately? Like not attractive, but just like ready to snap at any minute?
Yes.
Okay.
I have to work with the public every day. Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure you see it way more than me. It just seems like everyone is like meaner than usual.
Yeah.
Less patient, more judgmental. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I get it. There's a lot happening in the world with politics and with our reckoning with racial trauma and the pandemic. It's just people are just very on edge. And it seems to just kind of be trickling down into everything. And today I had 2 very unpleasant encounters.
Oh, no.
The first one was work related, which like, whatever, I'm a freelancer, so I just won't work with this person again. Not a big deal. But the second one was my neighbor.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And
your new neighbor.
My brand new neighbor in my tiny town that has like less than 500 people who live here year round.
Oh, no.
And what happened, without exposing too much on this podcast, I'll tell you about it later. She marched over to my house and knocked on my door at about 5:30, right when I was cooking dinner. And I answered the door with Rory because, of course, it's the neighbor lady. Like we've been friendly. We've talked. She's nice, whatever. And she's proceeded to berate me without asking if I even knew about the thing she was coming to complain about or had anything to do with it or could please possibly change it. Just basically tore me up one side and down the other without letting me get a single word in.
Oh my gosh.
Right in front of my daughter.
Ugh.
And then just turned and stomped back to her house.
What the hell?
And it was just like the most hostile confrontation I've had in years about something super minor.
Oh no.
It was just very unpleasant. And now I'm like, where do we go from here?
Yeah.
Like, do I just ignore you and pretend you don't exist? Do I like try to apologize and fix things? I don't know. I don't know.
Yes.
So
that's a hard situation.
It's very odd. So yes. I've been thinking about it a lot and about like the way that we perceive what we're passionate about and the way that we're perceived by others with that passion are very different things.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's complicated. That neighbor doesn't know anything about me or my life. She doesn't know that we've been sick with a toddler for like 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I don't know anything about her. Like, maybe she's had the worst neighbors ever.
Sure.
And she feels like the only way to get in front of it is to like come out swinging.
God.
I don't know.
Heads up. That's not the way.
That's not the way, especially when you are like the only 2 year-round residents on like your entire street.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I've just been ruminating on it and just very interested in like the dynamics there. And it has me thinking a lot about how people's sense of righteousness about some things can just become so ugly. And how we also forget that sometimes people who are heated are really just going through something that we don't understand. So we should give them grace. Mm-hmm. And I think women especially bear the brunt of that. Like we're not allowed to be angry. So I'm trying really hard to like leave space for that. And, you know, I don't know. I'm still figuring it out. But I know that I want to like examine it a little further. And that's why today I am bewitched by Carrie Nation, the hatchet wielding saloon destroyer of the temperance movement.
Ooh. The saloon destroyer.
Yes. She's a very complicated historical figure, and I'm very interested about her story.
Okay.
All right. So as I take a drink of my wine.
And also hatchet. So Tom listened. Our third Halloween episode went up today as we're recording right now. And one of the first things Tom said to me when I came home was, I need to show you what a hatchet is. like, someone could easily kill someone with a hatchet with one blow. And I was like, okay, but I was like picturing a tiny Italian grandmother like, with a hatchet.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
It was impressive for her to kill someone.
Yeah.
One blow with a hatchet.
I mean, when I think of hatchet, I think of like the one that like my parents let my brother use to like cut apart tiny twigs when we were like camping.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Is this the same hatchet that this woman uses?
I don't know. Could be. It could be. She could have passed it along. All right. So a little bit of background on Prohibition. By the year 1830, the average American over 15 years old drank nearly 7 gallons of pure alcohol per year. it's a lot.
How does that compare with our drinking 151 in college? Or 153? Whatever. Yeah, it was 153.
Well, I can tell you that's about 3 times as much as the average person drinks today.
Wow.
So it would probably be like our college Friday nights, like every day of the week.
Oh, God. No. How did they get anything done?
Well, it was a bit of an issue.
Suddenly, it all makes sense.
Yeah. So historians call the era from 1830 to 1850 an age of reform in America. Mm-hmm. And there's not really any one consensus on what sparked this sudden desire in Americans. But some historians attribute it to an outburst of Protestant evangelicalism or a delayed reaction to the perfectionist teachings of the Enlightenment. And some attribute it to like the revolution that was happening in communications. Some say that, you know, it was because of things that were happening in regards to like the abolition of slavery. We were looking deeper into ourselves at things that we could improve. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I believe that because it's still really not happening for most people today.
Yeah, no.
So whatever the cause, a lot of good arose from the movement. So you had women's rights movement, mm-hmm. Prison reform, improving the conditions of the working class, universal education, improving conditions for the mentally ill, and of course, the fight for the abolition of slavery. Mm-hmm. And among American Protestants, they viewed the fervor as a chance to cleanse the nation from sin. And what was really unique about the movement was that for the first time, really, people were pulling together in these volunteer associations designed to spread the message and gather supporters. That had never really happened before because people were, you know, so spread out across our country or had such different beliefs that mm-hmm. just, you know, you gathered at church, but that was kind of it.
Right.
The two strongest of these campaigns that remained after the Civil War were those of the temperance movement and the women's rights movement. Mm-hmm. And I was really surprised in doing this research that those two things are way intertwined.
Yeah.
Way more than I realized.
Yeah.
So obviously temperance had its background in the belief that overindulgence is a sin, you know, and it, too much of a good thing is a bad thing.
Sure.
And the sin of alcoholism was just a great fuel for other sins, you know, laziness and bodily harm and promiscuity, incurring social costs, things like that. Mm-hmm. But it was also extremely damaging to women in particular because they had no rights.
Sure.
So once they were tied to a man who abused alcohol, there was no getting away from him and nothing that they could do about it.
Yeah, I can't go get a divorce.
Right. And there was no telling which man might become afflicted. Alcoholism, as we know, is indiscriminate. It affects mm-hmm. all classes, all races, all walks of life.
Yeah.
So when you had a man who was abusing alcohol, who couldn't keep a job, who was in trouble with the law, who was neglectful or abusive to his family, there was nothing women could do. They couldn't work. They couldn't leave him. They couldn't even really report him to the authorities.
Yeah.
They couldn't vote to make changes. Like, nothing. So if women had won their rights prior to the temperance movement, it probably wouldn't have been nearly as successful. It needed the backing of women who were pissed off at drunk men. Alcohol became, the temperance movement thought, even more problematic following the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And that was because, I'm sorry, did you want to say something?
Oh, no, I'm just thinking probably there's some pretty heavy PTSD going on after perhaps, the Civil War. Maybe. Perhaps. I don't know.
You know. I don't know. Maybe, you know, like slaying your own countrymen could be... It'd be problematic.
Having a doctor hack off your leg while you're fully awake.
Oh my God.
Just tossing it behind him.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
Yeah. So in addition to that horrendous PTSD that probably nearly all men in the country were suffering from.
Yes.
There was also an influx of immigrants. Mm-hmm. Mostly from Europe, flooding mm-hmm. into American cities. And those immigrants, of course, brought with them their traditions and habits from their homelands. And we know, like, something that helps people feel at home when they're homesick is having, like, their comfort foods and their mm-hmm. comfort drinks.
Absolutely.
I mean, everyone wants a drink when you're, like, in an unfamiliar place.
Yeah.
So the brewing business boomed as German Americans began producing millions of gallons of beer. The Irish brought their whiskey, the French brought their wine, the Russians mm-hmm. brought their vodka, mm-hmm. and alcohol was just suddenly a lot more prevalent and readily available. Mm-hmm. And, you know, white Christian women didn't like it. And like I said before, like, probably rightly so.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyways, in 1874, a group in Hillsboro, Ohio, organized the first Women's Christian Temperance Union.
Okay.
And their stated purpose, when officially announced at a national conference in 1875, was to create a sober and pure world by abstinence, purity, and evangelical Christianity.
Of course.
Yeah.
You can't be a good person unless you're an evangelical Christian.
Yeah, naturally. That's where all the best people are.
Oh, I'm sorry. So I was thinking about that specifically today because I saw a car with a bumper sticker that had, like, you know, the little Jesus fish, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other side of his car had a sticker that said, "Joe and the hoe have got to go."
No.
Yeah.
Oh, so my it's like, gosh.
Claiming moral superiority and then calling the vice president a hoe simply because she's a woman. Got it. Okay. Mm. Mm.
Oh, that makes me think of that correspondent for The Daily Show. What's his name? Jordan Kepler?
Yeah.
Who goes to the political rallies, and he was talking to that one guy, and he was like, "You know, we got to respect women." And he's like, "Can you read your shirt to me one more time?" Trump that bitch.
It's like, and they can't see it. They can't. See it.
I know. It's so bad.
So this is where it started. No.
Yeah. And I don't blame women for being angry. I don't.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, but come on. So anyways, this group was led by some incredible feminists, and they did a lot of really great things for the women's rights movement. And by 1890, it was the largest organization of women in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is pretty incredible.
Yeah. They're not allowed to do anything. How do they even meet with each other?
I know, right? Yeah. Oh, and they fought for prohibition, yes, but they also fought for lots of other social reform issues like labor laws, public health, sanitation, and of course the right to vote. Mm-hmm. And it was actually incredibly important to the success of the Women's Rights Act because at the time, most women were either forbidden or terrified of joining feminist groups because they were, quote-unquote, radical. But by tying it directly to religion, the WCTU was able to recruit thousands of members because it was deemed more appropriate or traditional.
Right.
So under this guide, the WTCU got a lot accomplished. They united Northern and Southern women and included Black women, although most chapters were usually segregated. Mm-hmm. They worked to create legislations to protect working girls from the exploitation of men, including raising the age of consent, which was huge at the time.
Yeah.
They raised and donated significant money to their center on Ellis Island, helping new immigrants assimilate. Mm-hmm. But at the very, very core was their desire to abolish alcohol. Mm-hmm. And that's how they made most of their progress. They convinced women that if they gained all these other rights, once they could vote, they could get rid of alcohol.
Right.
They had a lot of faults, like by proclaiming it as a Christian group, they isolated many groups of people who were actually very anti-alcohol, mm-hmm. like Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus. Mm-hmm. They also promoted the idea that immigrants were more prone to alcoholism than quote unquote Americans, as if we aren't like two fucking generations into America at this point.
You're right. Immigrants.
Right. They spread narratives that if poor people would only abstain from drinking, they would be able to move up in life. Mm. So some seriously bad stuff mixed in with the good that they were accomplishing for women's rights.
Yeah.
All right. So now I'm going to introduce you to Carrie. So Carrie Amelia Moore was born on November 25th, 1846 in Garrard County, Kentucky, mm-hmm. to George Moore and Mary Campbell Moore. Her father wanted to spell her name C-A-R-R-Y, and he recorded it in the family Bible as such, but typically she went by the more usual spelling of C-A-R-R-I-E.
Okay.
Until later, she would kind of reclaim that spelling because it worked better for her personal brand to be Carrie, mm-hmm. because her name then was Carrie A. Nation.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So anyways, the Moore family lived on a farm, and Carrie had several siblings. She spent a lot of time with her family's enslaved people, often sleeping in their quarters and joining them for their worship services. But with the Civil War approaching, George Moore sold everything and moved the family to High Grove Farm in Cass County, Missouri in 1854, kind of hoping to outrun politics, I guess. Mm-hmm. But they found that people were still annoyingly divided on political issues there and moved again in 1862 to Texas, and then the next year back to Missouri.
Huh.
Then they were forced out by the Union Army and moved to Kansas City. So this is all just to say that it was a childhood full of lots of instability and hardship. Mm-hmm. Her family was at many times impoverished. Her mother suffered from terrible mental health issues. She went through a period where she believed that she was the Queen of England.
Oh my goodness.
Like to the extent where they asked their enslaved people to dress up like British footmen.
Wow.
And Carrie herself was a very sickly child. But after the war, the Moores returned to their farm. And due to that constant moving, Carrie's education was very, you know, intermittent. Mm-hmm. When she was 21, she married a man named Charles Gloyd. Dr. Charles Gloyd was a decorated Union Army physician. And Carrie was madly in love with him. Mm-hmm. Like very non-typical romantic love for that time.
Sure.
They wrote each other romantic and even sometimes salacious letters.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. But she didn't realize before their marriage that he had a severe problem with alcoholism.
Ah.
Probably from sawing people's legs off and tossing them over his shoulder.
That's exactly right. That's where it came from.
Mm-hmm. So Charles would spend hours at the Masonic Lodge or at the tavern drinking until dawn. He was, you know, very uncaring of his patients. He couldn't keep up with them. He couldn't keep like a steady, you know, patient load.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie became pregnant quickly into the marriage, but she knew by that point that Charles was not capable of providing for her or her child. So she did the very unusual thing of leaving him and moving back home.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Carrie and Charles's daughter was born on September 27th, 1868, and Carrie named her Charlian.
Oh.
After her father. Charles Gloyd died from alcoholism 6 months later.
Wow.
Yeah. So at 22... Carrie was widowed, penniless, and powerless.
Oh my gosh, baby.
I know.
Oof.
With a baby.
With a baby. Baby with a baby.
So Carrie sold some land that her father had given her, and she sold all of Charles's books and his medical equipment and used those earnings to build a small house in Holden, Missouri. And she lived there with her child and her mother-in-law, who greatly disapproved of her, but needed her care. She was not well. And this just sounds like literally every 20-something's worst nightmare.
Yes.
I cannot imagine.
Oh.
Carrie attended school at the Normal Institute in Warrensburg, Missouri, where she earned a teaching certificate. And she began teaching in Holden and continued for 4 years until she met David Nation. David was a widower with children of his own. He was 19 years older than Carrie.
Oh, I thought, okay. I thought you were going to say he was 19. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
That might have been better for her.
Yeah, maybe.
You're going to learn she likes a man she can control. at the time they married, David was a journalist for a Warrensburg newspaper, but they relocated to Texas in 1877, where he began practicing law, because I guess that was just a thing you could do if you were a man in the 1800s.
I'm going to be a lawyer now.
And Carrie worked managing a hotel in Columbia before buying and running one of her own in Richmond for 10 years.
Wow.
And during this time, Carrie grew deeply religious, but she always remained open-minded, and she enjoyed having theological discussions with Jewish people at her hotel. And it was during this time that Carrie says she began having visions and dreams from God.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. History of mental illness in the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
So shortly after, Carrie's husband, David, decided being a lawyer was not for him and decided he was going to become a preacher.
Of course. As one does.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of talking, so.
That's true. That is true. I bet it is very similar.
Yeah. It's just a lot of talking.
Yes.
A lot of talking and convincing.
You're preparing based on, like, old texts that you're trying to make relevant to your case somehow.
Yes.
Oh, man. I think we've cracked it.
That's it.
So when he decided to become a preacher, the family moved to Medicine Lodge, Kansas.
That's a horrible name.
I know. I know.
I hate it.
I just, like, smell cough drops in the air.
I live in Medicine Lodge. Yeah.
So it was here in Medicine Lodge that she began her career of charity and religious work that would lead her to be known as Mother Nation.
Oh, well. Mm-hmm.
But she was not without enemies. Carrie routinely lodged and fed the downtrodden and destitute of Barber County, both black and white. Mm-hmm. Sometimes she let them stay for years at a time, mm-hmm. and this irked her fellow parishioners. She was expelled from the local Methodist church, then the Episcopal church. And then when a preacher at the Medicine Lodge Christian Church denounced Carrie's neighbor as an adulteress based on nothing but the word of her alcoholic husband, Carrie wouldn't stand for it. Uh-huh. So in the middle of his sermon, she stood up and shouted down the unjust accusation and lectured the preacher himself
on spreading my rumors. God.
This was in the middle of a service.
This is fantastic.
The church elders tried and failed to drag her from her pew.
Oh my gosh.
But after the service, she was officially expelled from that parish as well.
And her.
I know. That's why I just feel so conflicted about her, because there's a lot of her that I'm like, hell yes, I love you for this.
Yeah.
Oh. But Carrie was not even a fan of her own husband's preaching. She took it in hand to guide and instruct his work, telling him which text to use and even writing his sermons.
Wow.
She was fond of having him preach about smoking, drinking, and other sins. And while he preached, Carrie sat in the front row and directed him. So she would signal him.
she was a stage wife.
She was. She would signal him to either raise or lower his voice, speak slower or faster, and even to make certain facial expressions. And then, when she felt the message had been made, she would step into the aisle and say, "That will be about all for today, David."
Oh my gosh! You're done.
And if he failed to stop speaking, she would walk to the pulpit, shut his Bible, hand him his hat, and tell him to go home.
Oh my gosh! Yes!
Oh, okay. So I'm not saying that Carrie was right in those actions. Like, if I were her husband, I would probably be pissed.
Yeah.
But also, I'm trying to remember that women had no rights.
Yes.
Carrie herself could not become a preacher and share her views. Mm-hmm. So right or wrong, she felt so strongly that this was her purpose in life. And that was, like, her only way of trying to do it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I can't imagine the frustration of trying to, like, fulfill what you believe your purpose is and having no other avenue than through a man. Yeah. Sounds awful. So undaunted, Carrie continued to collect food and clothing from all over Barber County. She pressured store owners to donate additional groceries, and she worked as a volunteer evangelist. She asked each inmate what caused their misery and woe, and everyone answered, drink. But this was confusing to Carrie because Kansas had actually been under statewide prohibition for a while. But an inmate told Carrie that whiskey could be obtained in the town of Kiowa on the border with the Oklahoma Territory. So Carrie, throughout her entire career, has always maintained that the man who is an alcoholic is not the sinner. It's not his sin. The sin is the drink and the man who sells the drink to the alcoholic. So she pleaded the man's case to the bailiff and then to the county attorney, arguing that the men running the saloons in Kiowa should be in prison, not the alcoholics. Her fight took her all the way to Topeka, where she sought help from the attorney general to no avail. The governor wouldn't budge either. And Carrie concluded that, quote, Kansas was in the power of the bitter foe to the Constitution, meaning the liquor business. The liquor business paid bribes and kickbacks at all levels of the government, local, state, and federal, to protect their money-making schemes. So Carrie determined that nothing could be done but to tackle the problem herself. So she became president and founder of Barber County's Women's Christian Temperance Union. And she worked to end the sale of illegal alcohol through every nonviolent action she could think of. So she started with simple protests like standing outside of saloons and greeting the bartenders by saying, this is my favorite, good morning, destroyer of men's souls.
Wow.
Hey, maybe that's how I should greet my neighbor. Maybe that's the solution.
It's soft.
She also gathered with other WCTU women to sing hymns and pray loudly outside of the saloons, because that's what you want to hear when you're getting a buzz on. She wrote letters, circulated petitions, organized marches. Remember, at this time, women had no voting rights and really no rights at all. So there was little recourse that she had other than praying and begging and writing. And she soon became frustrated. So Carrie says that what happened next was an order from God. Nation prayed for divine guidance. And on June 5th, 1900, my paper says 1990, but that is definitely not correct.
Remember, those are the 1900s.
She heard the words spoken into her ear. Go to Kiowa. She says her hands were then lifted and thrown down before she heard the voice say, I'll stand by you. Carrie said, quote, I was impressed with a great inspiration. The interpretation was very plain. It was this: take something in your hands and throw it at these places in Kiowa and smash them. Now, Carrie was a large woman for the time. She was 6 feet tall. Yeah, which is real tall for a woman.
Woman.
And she was muscular. She also had a stern face and was not afraid to speak her mind to anyone, which was very unusual during this era where women were told to be quiet and let men speak. So Carrie hitched her buggy and rode 20 miles south to Kiowa. Early the next morning, she paid a visit to the illegal, unlicensed bar of Mr. Dobson, who happened to be the brother of the county sheriff. It goes all the way to the top. She told him, quote, Mr. Dobson, I told you last spring to close this place and you did not do it. Now I have come down with another remonstrance. Get out of the way. I do not want to strike you, but I am going to break this place up.
Oh my gosh.
And with hands full of rocks and bricks wrapped in newspaper, Carrie began destroying the whiskey bottles, mugs, and tumblers, and the giant mirror behind the bar.
Oh my gosh, she's doing it.
She's doing it. The men inside had no idea what to think. They were terrified.
I'm sure.
And they just all huddled in the corner as she destroyed everything in the place.
Wow.
When she was done, she walked across the street to another saloon and did the exact same thing. When she ran out of bricks and rocks, she began using the billiard balls from the pool tables.
Resourceful.
Yeah. By the time she had finished up in a third saloon, word had spread around town and the saloon owners had locked up and were standing outside ready to fight Carrie off.
Oh my gosh.
And it's important to note that this was all happening at 8:30 on a Thursday morning.
No!
So once again, I'm not saying that she's right, but I'm also not saying that I can't identify with the rage that she felt at the men who were in charge of her life, of every sure. single woman's life, mm-hmm. who were running the state mm-hmm. and were at bars getting schwasted at 8:30 a.m. on a workday.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Oh, yeah. So I just think of like all their wives who were home alone with their 13 children, just having absolutely no choice but to seriously. Just pray that their husbands would go to work and not to the tavern. So maybe they could feed their kids that night.
Yeah.
Oh, and I feel that rage in my stomach and I get it. We didn't know a lot about mental health then. We didn't know that alcoholism was a disease and that there mm-hmm. were ways to treat it other than this.
Right. It does seem kind of ahead of her time that she was, you know, not necessarily blaming the person doing the drinking, which,
right.
I mean, it's not the person giving the liquor's fault either, because, you know, but
yeah, like how many options were there to make money in rural right. Oklahoma and Kansas in the early right. 1900s?
Yeah, but realizing that, you know, the alcoholic, you know, it was I'm sure she didn't call it a disease, but she knew something was going on.
Right. Like. Yeah, she was very progressive in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
So Carrie had destroyed three saloons at this point. And everyone is just kind of like gathered on the streets of Kiowa wondering what's going to happen next. And the police show up.
Uh-oh.
Just, you know, never good. Mm-hmm. And Carrie tells everyone, quote, "I have destroyed three of your places of business. And if I have broken a statute of Kansas, put me in jail. If I am not a lawbreaker, your mayor and your councilmen are. You must arrest one of us, for if I am not a criminal, they are."
Oh my gosh.
She's pretty fucking brilliant.
Yes.
Like, she's totally forcing their hand.
Yeah.
So the town marshal, the mayor, and the city attorney all huddle up, and they decided not to press charges.
Whoa.
Yeah. So Carrie returned home triumphant, and she became a celebrity in the newspapers overnight. And her actions actually kind of worked, because all of the legal saloons in Barber County closed.
Wow.
Yeah.
She did it.
She did it. And then there was this quote from a Slate article that I wanted to share that kind of speaks on her belief that God was talking to her. So it's, "And yes, Carrie Nation claimed that God spoke to her and told her to, quote, go to Kiowa and make war on the saloons, though that does not invalidate her activism. After all, 2 years prior in 1898, President William McKinley claimed that God spoke to him and commanded him to make war on Spain, take their colonial possessions, and, quote, civilize and Christianize them. But we don't teach that the Spanish-American War was due to McKinley's supposed insanity or menopausal hot flashes."
Oh, snap.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was important, like, to remember, because during this time, that's how men were making decisions. They were saying that God told me to.
Yeah, yeah. So, and nobody questioned it.
Right. It's not any less valid for her to say it.
Mm-hmm.
So Carrie said that next, God guided her to Wichita. And at 8 a.m. on Wednesday, December 28th, she went into the bar at the Carrie Hotel, which was the most luxurious in the city. And Carrie says of this, quote, "I decided to go to the Carrie for several reasons. It was the most dangerous, being the finest. The low doggery will take the low and keep them low. But these so-called respectable ones will take the respectable, make them low, then kick them out."
Wow.
So at the Carrie Hotel, Nation hid a wooden club and an iron bar, along with her supply of stones under her long black cloak, which would later become her trademark look. And she used her weapons to destroy every bottle in the place, along with a painting of a nude Cleopatra at her bath. That ain't good either.
Get it out of here!
And the whole while, she preached and lectured the cowering men about the dangers of alcohol.
Can you imagine being drunk?
Oh my gosh.
Someone is lecturing you while smashing up a bar.
A woman in a black cloak who looks like a legit Dementor. It's just smashing up your bar and lecturing you.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, so the hotel detective found Carrie beating the long curving bar with a brass spittoon. And the detective said, "Madam, I must arrest you for defacing property." And Carrie responded, "Defacing? I am destroying."
Correction.
I know. Oh, I kind of love her. Oh, so Carrie was jailed for her destruction at the Carrie Hotel, having done some $3,000 worth of damage.
Oh my gosh.
Which in 2021 money is about $98,000.
Jeez!
Yeah. Oh, so she was in jail for 3 weeks, but she was never charged with a crime. Because, like, how do you charge someone for destroying something that's technically not supposed to be there in the first place?
Right. Yeah. But also, she was in jail for 3 weeks without being charged with anything.
Yeah, being a woman is awesome. So her husband, David, did have her released on a writ of habeas corpus. And he joked that she could have done far more damage with a hatchet than a rock. To which Carrie responded, "That is the most sensible thing you have said since I married you." Nevertheless, David Nation was growing weary of his wife's antics, and he filed for divorce within a year.
Okay.
But she kept his idea for using the hatchet. And she also donated her entire alimony to the founding of a home for drunkards' wives in Kansas City, which was the first domestic violence shelter in the state.
Wow.
Yeah. So again, like, so many conflicting things that I'm feeling about her.
Sure. Yeah.
Women all over the country who wanted an end to their own husband's drunkenness took notice, and a group in Enterprise, Kansas invited her there to smash their saloons. Saloon keeper John Schilling knew that he could not lay a hand on Carrie, even as she smashed his saloon to bits, berated him, and pronounced his wickedness to everyone on the street. But he couldn't stop his wife, Belle, from punching Carrie right in the face.
Oh my gosh! Fantastic.
It just gets better.
Oh gosh.
Saying nothing, Carrie staggered to a nearby butcher shop and emerged a few moments later with a chunk of raw beef over her swollen black eye and kept right on preaching.
I was kind of hoping she was going to hit the woman with the meat, but...
Oh, yes! Oh, just comes out with like a Flintstone-sized drumstick. Yes. Oh. The Schillings had also paid four prostitutes, their words, not mine, who kicked Carrie to the gutter, pulled her hair, and beat her bloody with sticks and whips.
Wow.
So she did not have an easy time of it.
No.
And over the next 10 years, Carrie was jailed over 30 times.
Whoa.
But she raised money from the sale of souvenir hatchets, which allowed her to pay her bail.
Wow. Souvenir hatchets. Who's making these things?
I saw some pictures. I'll post them on our Instagram. But there were some that were like little like pins. Uh-huh. Put on like your jacket and like a little hatchet.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah. She was physically assaulted repeatedly. A barkeeper smashed her over the head with a chair. She was pelted with rotten eggs and even shot at. She was, through it all, undeterred and unafraid, even telling one barkeeper who pushed a pistol to her temple, quote, "I am not afraid of your gun. Maybe it would be a good thing for a saloon keeper to kill Carrie Nation."
Wow.
Carrie thought that if she was murdered, it would prompt the entire nation to rise up and smash the bars.
That's pretty bold.
Yeah. And at this point, Carrie is like grandma age. I mean, she's like in her maybe her 60s. And she remained incredibly strong. Oh, sorry. She was 58. Okay. People witnessed the 58-year-old woman throw an iron cash register through a window, smash bars to a pulp, and rip the door off of an ice chest. And she did this all while preaching nonstop.
Oh my gosh.
I can't even like walk up the stairs and talk at the same time.
Same.
Carrie was often made fun of, but she didn't care. In fact, a group of college students lured her to campus by pretending to support her, and then they used her visit to mock and ridicule her. But instead of becoming angry, she suggested that women should have the power to change things through the democratic process of voting and turn the occasion into a speech on the topic of women's rights.
Wow. Joke's on you, people.
Yeah. After one smashing that led to her imprisonment, Carrie was bailed out by a black politician named Nick Childs, who helped her publish her first newspaper, The Smasher's Mail.
Yes! It's fantastic.
Carrie did a lot of speaking engagements across the country, and audiences described her as a thrilling and stirring public speaker. Hmm. If she was insulted by someone in the crowd, she could fire off a humiliating response. She was also well known to demand that black people be granted entry to all white churches before she would speak. Mm-hmm. And she was known for telling racists that they could leave if they were uncomfortable.
All right.
But not all of her causes would be remembered as notable. She strongly opposed fraternal orders, tobacco, foreign food, fine clothing, corsets, and skirts of improper length. She called her opponents rum-soaked, whiskey-swilled, Saturn-faced rummies. It reminds me of like that insult scene in Hook.
I immediately thought of Buddy the Elf calling people cotton-headed ditty muggins.
Yes! Carrie was known to grab cigars and cigarettes from people on the street. She ridiculed well-dressed people in front of their friends, and she even applauded the assassination of President William McKinley, telling a crowd that he secretly drank and that drinkers always got what they deserved.
Ooh, that's a bit harsh.
Yeah. She was also incredibly sexist and often stated that she believed all men were nicotine-soaked, beer-besmirched, whiskey-greased, red-eyed devils.
Wow.
Yeah, not a fan of men.
No.
Carrie toured the United Kingdom in 1908 and 1909. And the Brits had been expecting a violent, ill-tempered, evil woman from the way she had been portrayed in their newspapers. but they found that she had remarkable wit, strenuous vigor, a good sense of humor, a wise general outlook upon life, a kindly, even modest and assuming, an unassuming manner with the light of a visionary in her eyes.
Hmm.
So the Brits loved her. She was big in the UK.
She made it.
She was also willing to put her beliefs on the line. Once a physician tried to convince Carrie that alcohol was harmless, maybe even healthful, and she took it as a challenge. So she began chugging down one bottle of Schlitz malt after another until the doctor begged her to stop before the drink gave her alcohol poisoning. And she had proven her point.
Ding, ding, ding.
Carrie was also known to work closely with prostitutes and other quote unquote lowlifes and helping them seek a better life. She appeared in vaudeville, published an autobiography, published a newspaper, and acted in a play titled Hatchetation.
Hatchetation.
The Kansas WCTU presented her with a gold medallion inscribed to the bravest woman in Kansas.
Wow.
Yeah. And in her later years, Carrie moved to Eureka Springs, Arkansas. She wanted a quiet place to live and said Eureka Springs reminded her of Scotland, which she had traveled to on her lecture tour and loved. She purchased a large home there, dubbed it Hatchet Hall. And she she really owned this trademark. And she shared it with impoverished elderly, with women fleeing their abusive husbands, and with children in need of homeschooling. She dreamed of someday running it as a school for prohibitionists to teach them how to campaign. And though that didn't happen, she did succeed in building an intergenerational, self-reliant, sister-based commune that was ages ahead of its time.
Wow.
Carrie Nation died on June 9th, 1911, at the age of 64. So history would largely write Carrie off as a religious nut.
Mm-hmm.
In 1959, David Shaw wrote an article called Crazy Carrie, the Party Pooper. Are you tired, run down, and listless? Do you poop out at parties? So he claimed that he had scientific proof that Carrie's activism stemmed from, quote, the glandular difficulties of the menopause that allowed suppressed force to erupt violently.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God. And in 1962, Andrew Sinclair published the best-selling The Era of Excess, in which he called Carrie's behavior a result of, quote, suppressed sexual desire, which was perverted into an itching curiosity about vice, an aggressive purience which found its outlet in violence, exhibitionism, and self-imposed martyrdom. And Carrie would continue to be laughed at by male historians for decades. They wrote that she was a demented woman, a psychotic from a young age, that she was suffering from a well-defined strain of madness. And even Daniel Okrent's Last Call, which won the American Historical Association's prize for best book on American history in 2011, trivialized Carrie as an ugly, incoherent lunatic.
Jeez.
He wrote, Carrie Amelia Moore, Gloyd Nation, was 6 feet tall, with the biceps of a stevedore, the face of a prison warden, and the persistence of a toothache. Her mother believed herself to be Queen Victoria. Her religious passions led her to sit on her organ bench and talk to Christ.
Wow, so he's not like a douche.
Yeah, not real flattering.
No.
And Carrie was a little odd.
Mm-hmm, sure.
She did destroy property.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to read this passage from the Slate article because I think it puts it perfectly. It says, by playing up her eccentricities, mocking her femininity, fundamentally misconstruing her religious beliefs, and laughing off her convictions, historians have made Carrie Nation a paper cutout of the temperance movement, easily crumpled up and thrown away without ever needing to consider that her grievances actually had merit. Sure. Saloon keepers were acting illegally. Mm-hmm. Politicians and law enforcement were corrupted by taking bribes to look the other way. Women were marginalized, disenfranchised, and powerless to stop it. Mm-hmm. A predatory liquor traffic was making money hand over fist by getting men addicted and then bleeding them and their families to death.
Yeah.
If a man had done the things Carrie had, he would have likely been praised by history. And Carrie always declared her motivations clearly and consistently. You wouldn't give me the vote, so I had to use a rock.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. So true. They can just brush women away by saying they're silly or
right. Yeah.
Hysterical or anything, really.
Yeah. She must be sexually repressed.
Oh, yeah. That's why.
So, yeah, Carrie destroyed property. She was excessive in some of her views and had little regard for personal liberties that conflicted with her steadfast beliefs. Mm-hmm. But she was also anti-racist, a champion of the poor, a fierce feminist, and an incredible leader. And she died 9 years before her goal of national prohibition came to be. That would, of course, end up being a hideous failure. That would create serious problems.
Yeah.
But along with it came the right to vote for women.
Mm-hmm.
The two political aims were so closely tied in many ways that I kind of wonder, like, if one would have succeeded without the other.
Yeah.
Carrie died with little money, and she was laid in an unmarked grave in Belton, Missouri, beside her mother. But the WCTU later erected a large gravestone with the quote, "Faithful to the cause, she hath done what she could."
Aww.
And then in the 1950s, the WCTU purchased the home she had owned in Medicine Lodge, and it is now a National Historic Landmark.
Cool.
And that is what I know about Carrie A. Nation.
Amazing. What a badass.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the courage that it must have taken to stand up to men in that time.
Yeah. Seriously, and ones that were corrupt, so there was really no ramification if they did anything to her.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. Okay, so I do have a few recommendations. First up, for nonfiction, Carrie A. Nation, Retelling the Life by Fran Grace. This is a feminist historian who wrote a well-received biography of Carrie A. Nation. Mm-hmm. And in it, Fran Grace unfolds a story that often contrasts with the common public image of Carrie as Crazy Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
Using new available archival materials and placing Nation in her various historical and cultural contexts, Grace retells the Crusaders' tumultuous life. This complexly woven and delightfully written biography begins the work of recovering Nation's often fascinating, often disturbing life. Hmm. And then another nonfiction is Smashing the Liquor Machine, A Global History of Prohibition by Mark Lawrence Schrad. And unlike many traditional dry histories, Smashing the Liquor Machine gives voice to minority figures who resisted the global liquor industry and further highlights that the impulses that led to the temperance movement were far more progressive and varied than American readers have been led to believe.
Cool.
And then for fiction, the first one is called The Gilded Years by Karen Tanaby. And this is based on the true story of Anita Hemmings, who in the 1890s was the first Black student to attend the hotbed of women's suffrage, Vassar College. Mm. And she successfully passed as white until she befriended the wrong person and dared to enter the world of moneyed New York. And then next up is The Lions of Fifth Avenue by Fiona Davis. It's 1913, and Laura Lyons lives with her husband, superintendent of the New York Public Library building, mm-hmm. and their two children in an apartment located in the Grand Building on Fifth Avenue. But Laura wants more. She applies to the Columbia Journalism School, and her world is cracked open. She discovers a radical all-female group where women loudly share their opinions on suffrage, birth control, and women's rights. Soon, Laura finds herself questioning her traditional role as wife and mother. But when valuable books are stolen at the library, threatening the home and institution she loves, she's forced to confront her shifting priorities head on.
Oh, that really reminds me. There is a children's book called Story Keepers, mm-hmm. and it's about a family that lived in the New York Public Library, and a stamp collection is stolen.
Ooh. So I wonder if
they're the same inspiration.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a really cute story. It's a juvenile fiction, but it's really cute.
God, what a dream to live right? in the New York Public Library.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I have one YA recommendation. It's called The Downstairs Girl by Stacey Lee. So by day, 17-year-old Jo Kuan is a lady's maid for one of Atlanta's wealthiest families. By night, she moonlights as the pseudonymous mm-hmm. author of a newspaper advice column called Dear Miss Sweetie. As her column becomes more popular, she uses it to address society's ills and challenges traditional ideas of gender and race. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of those are not closely tied to prohibition, but tied to some of the other historical context of what was happening at the time.
Yeah. It's an interesting time period.
Oh my gosh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think women were just so desperate to have just any chance at happiness at all that they were kind of willing to do whatever they had to do.
Yeah, with a hatchet.
With a hatchet.
Super cool.
Yeah. First episode of season 2.
Yay! It was a good one.
Well then, we are back at it, back to our normally scheduled programming.
Yes, yeah, every Wednesday. Yeah.
And if you guys have any suggestions for topics you'd like us to cover, please reach out to us.
Yeah.
You can email us at thereferencedeskpod@gmail.com or DM us on Instagram. We're at thereferencedeskpod.
Well, right. We'll see you next week.
We will.
Yes.
Yay.
Right. Still don't know how to end the show.
Bye, friends.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Reference Desk.
Please subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
If you're interested in any of the books we talked about on this episode, you can find them all, and more like them, at your local library.
And if you'd like to purchase a book, please use our affiliate link at bookshop.org/shop/thereferencedeskpod. That's bookshop.org/shop/thereferencedeskpod, all one word.
Follow us on Instagram at thereferencedeskpod and check out our website at thereferencedeskpod.com, where you can find our show notes, a full list of our sources, and all of our book recommendations.
Until next week, we'll see you in the stacks.